Good morning, and welcome to another episode of Crime Over Coffee. We're your hosts. I'm Erica.
And I'm Abby. Today, we're going to be interviewing Bob Cyphers, who has been investigating the uncaptured I-70 serial killer.
So pour yourselves a strong cup of joe, and let's dive in. First off, thanks, Bob, for being here with us. We really appreciate you. And Bob is an award-winning journalist and CBS reporter who is responsible and the author of the book Dead End, Inside the Hunt for the Interstate 70 Serial Killer. So, Bob, if you want to go ahead and just get started with how you got involved with this case and maybe give us a little bit of information about the case, the history of it, and how we got to where we are today with this book.
Sure, and thank you both, Eric and Abby, for the opportunity. Police departments are so desperate to get the information out, and I'm kind of the conduit for that. So back in 1992 in May, I was in the newsroom at KMOV TV in St. Louis, the CBS affiliate, as a producer, and I hear on the police scanner of a homicide call in the middle of a Sunday afternoon on a beautiful day at a brand new busy shopping center. And it was like, wow, who's going to kill somebody there in the middle of a Sunday afternoon, all the people around. So I grabbed a photographer and went out there and staked it out, and police have the thing roped off. And I wait till a police officer that I know comes up to me to talk. And he says, this is a bad one. I said, what do we have? And he says, a young woman by herself. And I said, a robbery? And he says, no, apparently they didn't take anything. I said, sexual assault? And he says, no, she wasn't touched. And it's like, disgruntled boyfriend? No, where we've called around and it looks like she wasn't dating. And it's like, well, what else do we have here? This was for Nancy Kitzmiller. And the police were like, we don't know. This is just bizarre. It's the middle of the day. And I said, well, how does he get away? He's not coming out the front door. All these cars in this parking lot, a killer's not going to walk into that. And they said, well, there's a back door, but it goes to a golf course with everybody out playing golf on a Sunday afternoon. He's not running through that. So it was just odd. And, you know, because I was there, I was interested. We waited a few days and nothing really happened. And then we got word of murders happening up and down Interstate 70 around the country. And finally, we got a ballistics match that the killing in St. Charles was connected to other killings that had already happened in Wichita, Terre Haute, and Indianapolis. And we knew we had a serial killer on our hands. And after that, my interest really got elevated. And then the case went cold for years. And, you know, once in a while there'd be a new update of something, but nothing really significant. You know, you live in a big city and work in the newsroom, there's going to be a lot of big stories and a lot of homicides, and they all tend to go together after a while. But with the serial killer angle, I was always interested in this one. And then in my last year at Channel 4 before I retired, I got a phone call from St. Charles Police that said, we're going to get the task force together one last time on this serial killer homicide, and we need a local media person to come and tell our stories, to travel the country with us. And we don't just want one story on the news. We're looking for something much, much deeper, and we're looking for somebody to commit to that. And that was going to be a tough sell for my employee because, you know, I still had a job to do every day with the newscast, but this was important. And I was able to get the okay on that and spent a month or so traveling to all the cities, Terre Haute, Indianapolis, St. Charles, obviously, Raytown, Kansas City, near Kansas City, and then Wichita. And, you know, meeting all the police departments, going to all the crime scenes, meeting families, friends, relatives, just, you know, reliving eyewitnesses, horrific crimes. and getting the police departments whatever information we could to keep the story alive in the public. And then I wrote probably 20 or 25 long-form magazine-style stories over my last year at Channel 4. We produced a 7-part documentary series that won a Murrow Award. And it kept the story alive for the police. We did our part of the bargain. And then I retired. And the task force was done. And police were like, "Hey, Bob, how you doing?" "Well, I'm playing bad golf. How are you going to, what are we going to do from here?" And it's like, "Well, what do you have in mind?" "I don't know." And it's like, "Well, if you could ever do anything else, let us know." And I thought, well, I can just start writing a book, and they like that idea. And so I sat down one day and I wrote a chapter, you know, Indianapolis, Robin Foldauer. And I called the publisher and I said, "Hey, if I do this, how many words do I need for a novel for this book to be realistic?" And they said 50,000 words. I said, okay. I went back and counted mine that I spent a couple of weeks on for the first chapter. I had 900. I knew I was a long way from 50,000. But I kept with it. And, you know, there's a book out now, and the police departments are happy. We're just hopeful that somebody picks it up and sees the clues in there, sees some of the new things in there that maybe weren't out in public before. Maybe they weren't even aware of the case before. And we're just hoping that one person somewhere makes a phone call to police. And I've gone out to promote the book for them. We've been to all the cities up and down Highway 70. I don't care if I make a dollar on the book. In fact, if whatever the book sells and I get a dollar for, by the time I put in my hours of work, it'd be like 8 cents an hour. So it's not for me. It's for the police department, for these detectives who have been haunted by this all these years, and just keeping my fingers crossed. And I tell every place I go, and I'll tell Abby and Erica, you the same thing, how cool would it be if one of the listeners to Crime Over Coffee or Coffee Over Crime is the one who hears this and picks up the phone and makes that call to police? How incredible would that be, that your listeners were part of that solving process? I just long for the day. How good would that be?
Yeah, I mean, that would be incredible. That's one of the main reasons that we started this podcast in the first place almost five years ago, was we wanted to try to bring attention to a lot of these unsolved cases that don't get attention and that have kind of been forgotten about, or people just maybe haven't heard about it, and so they don't realize what they should even be looking for.
Yeah. And to your point, Bob, you made, you know, you're talking about maybe people haven't heard of this case, or they just don't know the details. Some of the murders that have happened were Indiana based, and most people know that Erica and I are Indiana natives. And this is a case I heard about, but I really didn't know a lot of the details. And so I think something that would be really helpful today in this interview is to talk about some of the specifics with the murders that happen, and maybe what our listeners could look for, or if there's anything that could, you know, jog their memory, if there is a tip that could come in, what they should be looking for, or if somebody knows something, what they could be calling in with.
Sure. Well, let's start in Indianapolis with the first murder of Robin Foldauer. I go there to that scene, and she was killed at a Payless shoe store that's now a Batteries Plus store. So you can picture what that looks like in your mind. Just a small square block store with 5 or 6 parking spots right by the front door, small spots. Connected to the store, to the Payless store, just separated by, you know, 10 feet, is a Speedway gas station that's there now and was there then. And again, this killing occurs right in the middle of the day, with all the people coming and going at the Speedway. And again, no money taken, no sexual assault. All these are going to have the same motive, as police eventually figure out. What's the motive? You know what? Jeffrey Dahmer was picking up gay men. John Wayne Gacy, the same. Ted Bundy's trying to kill college girls. This guy, his only motive is the thrill of the kill. He's not taking money. He's not raping anybody. He's just walking in, pointing a gun, pulling a trigger, and leaving. So, but you're at the Speedway gas station there. All those cars coming and going. There's no getaway vehicle. There's no, you know, police first thought it might be a trucker because he goes from Indy to Wichita. You can't park a truck in the Payless parking lot. Is it possible? Police are now saying that he just, again, this 1990s is before credit cards were really in use at gas stations. Could he have pulled up to the gas station, walked in, said, here's $20 for gas, started filling up his tank, walked next door, killed Robin Foldauer, went back and got his car and just pulled away? All the cars coming and going. I mean, that's really amazing. And then just a couple days later, he's driving, you know, 600, 700 miles to Wichita to kill somebody. I mean, think of all the places he could have stopped along the way. He's gone that far. Why are you going to Wichita? And then the incredible story there was you got two women, Patricia Majors and Patricia Smith, working at a wedding store, and a caller calls them and says, hey, I got to come to a wedding at 7 o'clock. I'm right by your store, but I'm running 10 minutes late. You close at 6. I need a cummerbund. Can you stay open till 6:05? I'll be there. And, of course, the ladies say, sure, come on by. We'll leave the light on and the door open. So at 6 o'clock, what happens? The door opens, a man walks in, and they think it's the guy for the cummerbund. It's not. It's a man with a gun. He kills both of them. He's about to walk out. And then at 6:05, guess who walks in? The man looking for the cummerbund. Well, now the killer's got something new on his hands. Now there's an eyewitness who's looking at the face. He sees a gun wrapped in a wedding veil. The cummerbund man is able to talk his way out of the store and flee. But now we have a composite sketch. First composite sketch. Okay? So that's out there now. And now, with a couple killings along I-70, the departments don't talk to each other back then. There was no internet. There was no way to communicate, hey, is your killer my killer in Wichita? That wasn't happening. But he drives right back to Terre Haute, back to Indiana, where he started, where the FBI says he probably lived. Serial killers usually start where they live. So now he's in Terre Haute, and he goes to Sylvia's ceramic store, a woman's name. He goes in. But instead of a woman working, it's a man, Mick McCown, who might have long hair and might have a ponytail at the time, is back to the window. Serial killer kills him, flees. What's taken? Only one thing missing. Mick McCown's wallet's missing. They don't know if the killer took it or not. They don't know if the family's looked everywhere for that wallet to see if Mick left it at home. They don't know. And then finally, a couple days later, where I'm at in St. Charles. But here's why St. Charles is really the key. After St. Charles, they do ballistic tests. And they find out that the gun used is the goofiest gun you could ever dream of. It's called an Irma Werke. And this is where police are hoping somebody can hear this podcast, read the book, and say, I know something about that gun. There were so few of those guns in America. The Irma Werke was a World War I 1918 German Navy target pistol that barely functioned even at that time, much less 70 years later. Certainly not the gun you're going to use to kill somebody, not the gun you're going to use to be a serial killer, not the kind of gun you're going to pick up in the trunk of somebody's car. He had to have a reason to have this gun. They're hoping somebody recognizes that name and knows something about that gun. It's a big key for police. And they have the ballistics. And so St. Louis starts calling around because the St. Charles, St. Louis, the gun is so rare. It's like, does anybody else ever have a homicide with this gun? And what do they find out? Yeah, we had one in Indy just a couple days ago. Yeah, we had one in Wichita a couple days ago. Yeah, we had one in Terre Haute a couple days ago. That's when we first knew we had a serial killer, when the ballistics matched. And of course, he goes on to Kansas City and Raytown and kills one more. And at that point in time, a little controversy occurred because I got tipped off that the police had the gun, had the crazy gun, but they weren't releasing it to the public. They were keeping that behind as evidence. And, you know, I kind of lobbied with them like, look, you know, this is information the public has a right to know. I'm a journalist and this needs to be out there. They didn't want to do it. Well, I wasn't going to impede the investigation. At the same time, I had sources and my bosses knew I had something going on there and they wanted some story and I'm kind of caught in between. I was never going to release the information, but I was lobbying with police as they started having internal discussions about whether that should be made public or not. And finally, they decided to. And the killing stopped. He'd already killed in Raytown now, but as soon as we released the information about all the ballistics, the killings stopped. All in 1 month. And at first we thought like, well, at least we stopped the killings. He knows we're out there. He knows we've got that goofy gun. He knows that can get him. And the killing stopped. Or did they? Because a year later in Texas, the same thing starts again. Woman alone in a store, off the side of the highway, in a strip mall, killers in and out with a shot to the head. But now it's a different gun. The ballistics aren't the same as they are on I-70. So is that Texas killer the same killer? They just changed guns? What was he doing for that year in between? Or is it not the same killer? Is it a copycat killer? And then, of course, he goes down to Houston, and we get to meet Vicki Webb, who's a key part of my book and a key part of the police investigation and still is to this day. So every scene has a different story, a different angle. But the best one, I think, is in Raytown, where Sarah Blessing was killed. It's a suburb southeast of Kansas City. It's a strip mall, an older strip mall. Sarah had the store furthest on the right side ending of the complex. They had just opened it with five friends. It was a herbal store, a vitamin store. And that was her day to work as they rotated days. Right next to her, the store was a video store where the owner was a man named Tim Hickman. And Tim sees this well-dressed, preppy-looking guy walking across the parking lot, which is kind of a upscale dress from what they were used to for those types of customers there at that part of town. And the man walks right to his window and looks inside and looking around from the outside. And Tim's wondering, you know, what's the guy looking at? Is he going to come in? And they stare at each other for, you know, 5-10 seconds. And the guy disappears and goes out of frame. Tim thinks nothing of it. Well, the guy doesn't want to get a video. And 10 seconds later, Tim hears pop, 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 pop. And he realizes it's gunfire. And he runs outside and he goes to the store next to his and he sees Sarah Blessing laying there dead. He turns around the corner and looks and he sees the same man who was staring at him in his window running up a really steep hill to get away. There was no getaway car. He was running up a really steep hill. So Tim Hickman's the eyewitness. He's not the scared witness from Wichita who sees the man at a distance with a wedding veil. Tim Hickman sees the man right in his window. And Tim Hickman sees that man in his dreams every night of his life. But Tim Hickman's ready to identify somebody someday.
Wow. Bob, let me ask too, in the book, and correct me if I'm wrong, is this also the killing where there was a gentleman in the restaurant who maybe saw the killer as well?
Yes. So we go to meet Tim Hickman and the police department for Raytown, Chris Shroud, and to visit the store where the killing occurred. And after we do the story and do the interviews, we're ready to leave. And a man pulls up in a car and, you know, he says, are you from the TV station? I say, yeah. I figured it was just somebody who wanted to, you know, see how the TV gang worked. And he said, yeah, I saw you on Facebook. You guys are going to be out there today. I don't know how that happened, but somebody must have seen something or posted it. I don't know. Maybe they were our last stop, I think, or our fourth stop on the trip. So maybe he'd seen the others. But he didn't say much, and I just thought he was a passerby. And finally, he says, as we're getting ready to leave, he says, I was here that day. And I kind of looked at him, and I said, you were here when Sarah Blessing was killed? And he says, yes. Well, I'd gone through the police files, and I had talked to the police officers, and I nothing had come up about this guy. I knew that Tim was the only witness. And I said, did you talk to the police? And he said, no. I said, well, why not? He goes, I've always been afraid. He said, I'm still afraid. It's 30 years later. Guy's out there. And I said, you know, and I didn't know at first. You know, sometimes you have to be careful when you're a journalist on a scene. People can elaborate or, you know, exaggerate. And I said to him, I said, well, you know, will you talk to me, you know, on camera? And I'm thinking if I put that nugget out there, oh, yeah, I'll be on TV. He said, no, I'm sorry, I can't. Well, I'm sorry, I just won't. I just wanted to come by and tell you that I was here. That's all. Thank you. At that point, I realized he wasn't just looking for his 15 minutes of fame, and he was nervous. And we talked for a few seconds, and I said, look, I said, if you've got anything to add, I'm doing stories. Nobody needs to know who you are. Just let me know what you saw that day. And he didn't want to, but finally, I mean, he was shaking. Finally, he said, do you have to use my name? I said, no. Do I have to go on camera? No. I said, just tell me what you know, and I'll relay it to the police if you don't want to, and nobody's ever going to know who you are. You just leave here. And he tells me he was eating at a restaurant then that existed called Ginger's on the other side of the strip mall. And he says a man, a nice dressed, preppy looking man, walks in to look for a table. It's not that crowded. And he's just standing there for a while, looking around, scoping out the restaurant. And finally, a waitress comes up to him and says, sir, just seating for one. And the man doesn't say a word. He just turns and walks out the door. And the man tells me, he says, I just found it odd. Who walks into a restaurant, stands there to get seated, and then just turns around and leaves? It was just odd. And thought nothing more of it until the next day when he heard about the killing there at the exact same time. And then the description comes out with Tim Hickman's description, and it looks just like the man he saw. And he's convinced it was the killer. And he, too, 30 years later, like Tim Hickman, still is fearful, even with his name not being out there.
What's so interesting to me is how many people have seen this person, and yet we still don't have identification as to who he is.
Yeah, it is funny. The police department kind of feels like we've met this guy before. We've spoken to this guy. We just don't know which one it was. You know, they had a database. They checked every hotel record, every toll booth record, every campground record of all these cities for months to see if there could be, you know, any connection. And they felt like if they could ever place a guy in two cities at the same time, meaning he was in Wichita the day of the Wichita killing and he was in Terre Haute the day of the, if they could ever place one guy in multiple cities on the killing days, and they did, they found one guy, one. And boy, they checked him out. But his alibi was strong as could be, and they're convinced it wasn't him. But to show you how thorough they were in their search is they're calling every person on every phone list of every hotel record and whatever. One of the guys they wound up calling was Kevin Costner. And it was like, sorry, Mr. Costner, but we have to ask, if you're in between movie shoots, where were you the night of May 15th? Were you near, you were in Wichita?
Wow.
Is that true? Yes, I was in Wichita. And they don't
so
think
so funny.
Did.
Yeah. Yep, that's probably good to know. Well, that was another thing that struck me, too. I noticed in the book that there was an FBI profiler that came in, and one of the things was that there was a good chance they had maybe interviewed the killer at some point.
Yeah, they think the police department's investigations are so thorough. You know, you watch those shows 48 hours where they do so much early on. They just feel like they did so much work in five separate towns early on that chances are they stumbled into this guy at some point. The FBI profile in Quantico, Larry Ankrum, you know, so few people rise to be an FBI profiler. I mean, it's like rising to become a Supreme Court justice. I mean, he is a special, special man with knowledge. And as I talk to him, it's like, how do you profile
hello?
This? Bob's here.
Oh,
hello.
Erica?
Abby?
Yeah, we're still here.
Okay. So am I okay to continue?
Hello?
I think so.
Okay. So I'm talking to
I can
to
hear
Larry.
You, Bob. You go ahead.
Okay. I'm talking to Larry about the profile.
Oh,
and that's his,
hello?
That's Larry's job.
Can you hear me?
I can.
I'm going to text her, Bob.
That's okay. I'm on hold. Bob can hold.
Hold on. I'm texting her, letting her know.
I can't hear anything at all.
I can't hear Bob. That can, my wife would say that's a good thing.
Oh, wait. Speak.
Yeah, can you
hello?
Hear us?
Bob.
Now I can hear you.
Yeah, you must have cut out for a second.
I like it just went completely silent, but it's like every so often I could hear like a little pop of something. Okay, I'm sorry.
Nope.
I don't know
good.
Where I interrupted, but
we're talking about Larry.
Okay. Larry Ankrum, the FBI profiler, and
yes.
He studied every serial killer there is. And he says, we just have nothing to go on this guy. Nobody kills without a motive. I mean, it just doesn't happen. And now this guy's killing everybody without a motive. And he's killing it across the country without a motive. So they had nothing that made sense about this guy. Even the goofiest ones of all time, you know, Son of Sam saying he killed because his barking dog would tell him who to kill or something. You know, you can at least say, well, that's obviously insanity if his story is even remotely accurate. But with this guy, until they catch him, if they do, just no way. And, you know, in Wichita, the police detective there, Tim Ralph, this is his second serial killer case. Tim lived through the BTK killer case that terrorized Wichita for nearly 20 years as Tim was growing up there. Tim had to catch the BTK killer. Tim was haunted by that his whole life because as a young man growing up, the BTK killer was killing people where he lived, in fact, right down the street from where he lived. And Tim goes on to become a police officer and winds up in Wichita, and people retire, and guess what case lands on his desk? The serial killer case that had haunted him his whole life. And, you know, the BTK killer, though, was different. If you watch Zodiac, which was a great movie, or you look at the BTK killer, those guys were playing games with cops. They were communicating through the newspapers, trying to show how good they were. The BTK killer liked being called a serial killer. He'd leave a box of cereal on a road with an index card in it in the middle of the road where some car would have to get off and move it. And on the index card, it would say, tell the police to go to this house where they'll find a body. You know, he was just playing with the police. He wanted the attention. And then Tim Ralph starts communicating with him in classified ads in newspapers under fake names. And eventually the BTK killer wants more. Dennis Rader, he wants more. And he tells the cops, hey, let's get away from the newspaper. Technology's out now with computers. Can I send you this floppy disk to tell you where my bodies are? And Tim says, yeah, go ahead, send us the disk. And the BTK killer sends the disk. Police take it to forensic. They trace it to a local church. They go to the church to see who might have access to that computer. It was only the church deacon, Dennis Rader. Police check their records and see that at one of the cereal boxes picked up by the side of the road, they saw a black Chevy Trailblazer speed away. Tim gets an address for Dennis Rader where he lives. He drives to his house, and what does he see in the driveway? A black Chevy Trailblazer. And the next day, he's got the SWAT team there, and they arrest him. And in the back seat of the police car is Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, and in the front seat driving is Tim Ralph. So This isn't Tim's first rodeo. And, you know, Larry Ankrum kind of thinks that this guy might be trying to play with the police, or at least was at that time, by trying to do a little bit more maybe each time, to try to reach out a little bit more each time. Just not yet enough.
That was something I wanted to ask you. If you feel that this guy, like, you know, BTK and some of these other killers, is somebody who's just blending into society, working a normal day-to-day job.
Well, I just don't know how you do that. I I'm a guy that worked a normal day-to-day job for 40 years, and it was hard getting up every morning, putting on matching socks, and getting in the car and driving to work every day. It was hard enough as it was. So what happened here? We don't know. Now, there still are some other things, though, some other clues in that book that might help people if we think about who this could be. There was, like, jewelers use red rouge for cleaning jewelry. At all these crime scenes with the goofy Irma Warky gun, they find the red jeweler's rouge at all these scenes. Is there a connection there? Or you look at what could possibly be the biggest connection of all occurs after the serial killer, after Texas, 10 years go by, and right smack back in Indiana, in Terre Haute, a mile away from Sylvia's, where Mick McCown was killed, at a liquor store, a man comes in, goes to the back, a preppy-looking man, goes to the back and grabs a six-pack of beer. There's nobody else in the store, gets the beer out of the cooler, comes to the cash register, and instead of paying for the beer, pulls out his gun. He walks the cashier, a man named Billy Brossman, to the back of the store with a gun pointed to his head, shoots him and kills him, and then does a little celebratory dance as he's heading out the store, and he leaves. He doesn't even go pick up his beer. He doesn't even go to the cash register. So what's his motive? As Larry Ankrum would say, Bob, that was the thrill of the kill again.
And I genuinely feel like that's some of the scariest killers that have existed or that we've talked about or we've seen, are the ones who are solely in it for the kill. There's no motive. There's no anger. There's no anything. It's just they solely get off on killing people. And there's a lot of psychological things that you could get into with that, but.
Nope, you're absolutely right. The 100% randomness of that could be me next. If you're not a college sorority girl, Ted Bundy's not looking for you. If you're not a gay young boy, Jeff Dahmer's not looking for you. Here, this guy's looking for, well, women, brunette, I guess. But still, the randomness, he doesn't know anything about these people. There's no evidence he ever met any one of these people before in his life. He's got no reason to kill that particular person. And at almost all of these scenes, Robin Fuldauer in Indy, Mick McCown in Terre Haute, Nancy Kitzmiller in St. Charles, Sarah Blessing in Raytown. None of those people were supposed to be working that day. Through the twist of fate and their good-heartedness, they came in for fellow employees who were either sick or asked for the day off. Mick McCown had gone to a chiropractor that morning. His back was hurting, and they said, stay home. And Mick said, yeah, I don't want to make anybody else work. I'm going to go on in. Robin Fuldauer was covering for another coworker. Nancy Kitzmiller gave a friend the day off. Sarah Blessing was one of five who were rotating, and they swapped out dates. You just talk about the incredible fate, twist, bad luck. But as you go back to that Billy Brossman video, this is the best video your listeners are ever going to see of somebody being killed on live TV. They had security cameras now. They didn't have it back in the 90s. Back in the 90s, the only thing for store security was a bell that would ring when a customer walked in. But now there's a security camera, and it's clean as day behind Billy Brossman's counter. You can see the killer walk in. And police have the video. And they put it out on television news for weeks. And who comes forward? Nobody. So what does that tell the police? It tells them he's not from Terre Haute. Because somebody would have recognized him.
And but something later, I told...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, something I noticed in the book that was mentioned is that he also had a wedding ring on. Is that right?
He had a wedding ring on, and you can hear his voice a little bit. But here's what else, really, as police started spreading that video up and down I-70, a couple people start coming forward, and they've all got the same story. They don't know each other, but they've got the same story. Look, I used to hang around with a preppy-looking guy like that. I really can't tell by the face after all these years, but one thing that gives that guy away, the guy that I used to hang with used to have his pant cuffs rolled up really high. Haven't seen anybody else like that in years until I see the Billy Brossman video. Pant cuffs are rolled up really high and a preppy-looking guy. Okay, we got the Brossman video. The Wichita witness who walked in on the cummerbund guy has affected him so much that he really can't emotionally even speak anymore. He can't help the police. So who's the person out there that can, that has the ID, that stared at the killer face to face? That's Tim Hickman in Raytown. So I picked up the phone and I called Tim. Tim, have you seen the Brossman video? You ever heard of the Billy Brossman case? No. I'm going to send you a link. I want you to look at this. Because you've seen this guy in your dreams for 30 years. See him plain as day in this video. I send Tim the link. About 60 seconds later, I get a text back. And all it says is, yes. Tim's our best living witness. And the Billy Brossman case, I think, is our best chance to solve this. They need to find the Brossman killer, and that's your I-70 killer.
That gave me goosebumps.
Gives them to me, too.
Awesome. Oh.
I can give you more goosebumps if you want to talk about Vicki Webb.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's a great segue into the I-35 as well.
So a year goes by and two women get killed in Texas, Mary Glasscock and Amy Best. Same thing in Dallas. And before I move on to Vicki, just one little footnote here on Amy Best. As she was shot and killed, she was barely alive. She was able to crawl to a phone, bleeding to death, pick up the phone and call 911 and beg for an ambulance. She died. In St. Charles, Missouri, nothing to do with the Amy Best case in Dallas, Texas, under just the possibility that it could be the I-70 killer. But in St. Charles, Missouri, a detective that had this case for a long time named Pat McCarrick, who's an elderly man now that walks with a cane, as he kept on this I-70 case over and over and over as years went by, his bosses would tell him, hey, Pat, we have other stuff now more pressing. Maybe we should move on. Pat would say, let me play something for you. And he'd go to his desk drawer, and he pulls out the audio tape of Amy Best making the 911 call. And Pat plays that for his boss. And he says, every time the boss changes, I keep playing it. It's the same reaction. They just look at me. Neither of us can say a word. And the boss says, you're right. Stay on that case. But after the two Dallas women are killed, shortly thereafter, down in Houston, again off the highway, a woman named Vicki Webb is ready to go on vacation. She's got her store open for a weekend Saturday, busy crowd coming in. And sure enough, a killer comes in and kills her, shoots her, leaves her laying for dead. And as he's leaving the store, he looks and sees she's barely breathing. Vicky's playing dead. She says, "Bob, I've watched all those Hollywood movies, and why they get up and let the killer, you got to play dead." She knew what to do. But the killer thought she was still alive, so he came back to shoot her again. And when he does, the gun jams. Funny, it wasn't the Irma Werke, but it jammed. All she heard was a click. Vicky then hears some noise outside. The killer must have heard some people, so he fled. Vicky is still alive, barely. She has to go through months of surgery. She's only alive because the vertebrae in her neck was deformed, and it blocked one of the bullets. It blocked the bullet from getting through to her, the killer. But Vicky survived. But Vicky's scared to death. I mean, whoever tried, she doesn't know about the I-70 killer. All she knows is somebody tried to kill her, and she's alive. And the killer now, with the media coverage, knows she's still alive, and she's scared. She's scared. She's not talking to police. She's hiding. She winds up getting divorced. She moves around the country. She changes her name. She's gone underground for 30 years. As I'm writing the book, as a journalist, I'm saying, you know, the get here, the home run here, is if I can find Vicky Webb. Well, easier said than done. The police didn't know where she was. I tried the Houston police. I tried all the police, and nobody knew where she was. Nobody talked to her. So I now had to convince my work to, hey, let me go sit in that corner room for a few weeks or months, and I'm going to call every Vicky Webb in the world I can find. And they let me do it. And, you know, I had marriage records, real estate records, divorce records. I knew she was 30 at the time, so she's 60 now. You know, but it was a long shot. I probably had a list of about 600 Vicky possible women who were named Vicky Webb at some point in time who'd moved around the country like that, that were 60 now. And I start just cold calling them. And you know how it is. You get a phone call. First of all, you're lucky if a person even answers the phone that's not a person you know. I get hung up on all the time. Or if they did answer it and say hello, I'd say, "Hi, my name is Bob Cyphers," and I'd click. Call again. "My name is Bob Cyphers. I'm a news reporter." Click. I couldn't even get a full sentence out of my mouth. You know, I'm doing this day after day after day after day, hundreds of calls. But I was determined, and finally one day I call, and now I've got the whole thing written down an index card in front of me. I'm kind of like a mummy. "Hello, my name is Bob Cyphers. I'm a news reporter for CBS Television. I'm looking for the Vicky Webb who was shot and killed all these years, shot and left for dead." And I read this thing out, and I'm thinking, wow, I got through the whole thing. She must not be there. She must have hung up. There's just silence on the other end of the phone. And then I hear her say yes. And I pause, and it's like, I'm looking back at my card again. "Ma'am, I'm looking for the Vicky Webb who was shot and left for dead in Houston 30 years. "Yes." I said, "Is that you?" And she says, "It probably is." And it's like, oh, my goodness. You know, I had about 5 seconds to, you know, pat myself on the back and go crazy. And then I realized I'm on about the 5-yard line of a 100-yard field. I've got to talk her in now to telling her story after she wouldn't for 30 years. And that took some time. And I had to convince her who I was. I told her all my stories were on KMOV.com. I told her about the Murrow series. I asked her to go watch. I did not want to pry into her life, but I wanted to tell her story one way or another. And could we do that? And her answer was, "I don't think so, Bob, but thank you." Well, we kept in touch. Happy texting. "Happy Thanksgiving, Vicky. What's for dinner today? Merry Christmas, Bob. What'd you get the grandkids? Happy New Year, Vicky." You know, and that went on for a while. And I had to build up trust with her, really no different from a journalist building up trust with any other sources. And finally I did. And she read all the stuff I'd written. She was appreciative. And I finally get a text one day out of the blue. I see it's from Vicky Webb. And all it says is, "Bob, let's do it." Okay, time to get on the airplane and go. And sat down with Vicky. and what an incredible woman. Just so happy that our paths crossed in life. She's no longer afraid. She wants to go after this just like the police do and I do. And after she did that for us, and she's gone on People Magazine, she's gone on Discovery ID, she's come out of her hiding. And just like Tim Hickman, he's not hiding. We all want the same thing.
Yeah, I was very impressed with her strength reading the interview you did with her. I can't even imagine what she had gone through.
She is amazing.
Yeah, and the fact that she was finally willing to come forward and reached right back out to you is amazing.
Impressive.
And, you know, there's no guarantee the I-70 killer is her attempted killer. It might be. It could be. I kind of don't think it is, only because he spent more time in there than he did at the other locations.
Mm-hmm.
The others, for all we know, he was probably in and out. We don't know for sure, but we think he was probably in and out. I mean, you go back to Robin Foldauer, the first one is a Payless shoe store. He's got to go in there and do his dirty work while there's no customers in there. He can't be hanging around for half an hour, people coming and going. Same thing at all these places. At Vicky's place, he was in there for, you know, maybe 20 minutes. So and she described him as weathered and worn down. The Brossman video is he's still preppy looking. Tim Hickman says is Bobby's a preppy looking guy. So the description doesn't match, but you don't know. I mean, you just don't know.
Right. And I have one other question, just because when I was looking into the case and watching the documentaries, reading the book, there was some reported potential sighting or witness tip that really threw me. And it was the one with the gentleman who was running a construction site. And there was a man and a woman that came in and were interested in maybe working. And it was in the same city as one of the victims.
Indianapolis.
Is that right?
Indianapolis.
Yeah.
Same, murder number one, same exact time as Robin Foldauer was killed. Right around the exact time, a construction site, a car pulls in from Florida, a cream-colored Cadillac. A man and a woman are in the car. The man gets out and walks up to the construction site and asks for the foreman, finds the foreman, and the man says, "Hey, we're from out of town. I'm looking for work." And the foreman says, "Well, let me get you an application. Let me drive over here a couple blocks away. We'll go to the office and have you fill out an application." So the foreman gets back in his car. The man gets back in the car where the woman is. The construction foreman's in the front car. He looks in his rearview mirror, and he sees the woman hand the man a gun. So now the construction worker is a little concerned. He doesn't want any part of this. So he speeds away and tries to flee the car. The car is chasing him for a bit, but he's able to lose him and pull off somewhere and wait it out, and the car is gone. Within a minute, he hears a bunch of police sirens, and he thinks, wow, whatever just happened, they caught the guy. Well, the police sirens were going to the Payless shoe store where Robin Foldauer had just been murdered.
And what struck me, Go ahead, Bob.
Well, so the construction man doesn't think anything more about it. He wonders, you know, boy, I got away here. And then later there's this homicide, and he goes to the police department and says, look, this may not be connected at all. You know, all I know is this goofy thing happened to me a couple days ago, and this woman's killed, and the timing looks like it might be similar. And the police are listening to him, and he's very credible. And the police ask, is there any chance, and again, this was days later, is there any chance, when they had the ballistics, do you know much about the gun? Could you recognize the gun? And the Florida says, man says, yes, I am. I know a lot about guns. I recognize that gun for sure, let me tell you. So the police bring him downtown, and they show him or lay out pictures of like 10 different guns. He immediately picks the goofiest gun on the table, the Irma Werke. Now, man has a woman with him in the car. This was from Florida. This was 30 years ago. Who's the man? Well, if the man was the serial killer, and they can track names, and the serial killer might have been in a relationship or got divorced, there's a woman out there who police would like to talk to. And they're trying to find her.
That was what I found so interesting, is that there may have been someone else at least loosely involved with his killings if she was there with him during all of this. And how involved was she? That was just the first mention that I had heard with two people being involved. And it kind of came out of left field. And I was like, oh, that's just so different from the MO that we were hearing in all the other cases.
Yes, it could be. It could be something. It might not be. I can tell you that through the Brossman people who've come forward with a possible, I think I know who that guy is, and through their digging with the Florida car to try to find that woman and who might have come forward, police believe they have a potential suspect. Now, we're talking about a suspect in the Brossman case right now. So it's been another leap forward if they can connect the Brossman case to the I-70 case, which they believe they can. So where do they go? What do they need on the Brossman case? You know, I've come to have so much incredible respect for the police departments here. I mentioned about Pat McCarrick having the tape of Amy Vest in his drawer. By the way, Pat also has in his drawer an Irma Werke gun that he went and bought, that he takes to gun shows all the time, asking people if anybody's ever bought or seen a gun like this. These police department people are amazing. I am traveling on a media tour a few weeks ago. I am in one of the towns. And who shows up there in that town but a woman named Kelly Rhodes? She leads this task force now in St. Charles. Kelly was barely born 30 years ago when this thing happened. It was an icy, ugly February day. And Kelly has crossed state lines to go to some other department about this case from 30 years ago. So when you think, oh, they've given up, it's on the back burner. No, it's like, hey, Kelly, what are you doing here? Good to see you. Oh, Kelly, you're 8 months pregnant. These police detectives are all in on this.
Yeah, it's so great that there's so many people dedicated still. And, you know, there's different generations that are dedicated to it.
Most of these detectives that handle the case now, there are 4 and 5 and 6 detectives passed down from who originally handled the case.
Well, that leads me to ask the question. I mean, at this point in time, 30 years since the murders, really, do police still believe that the I-70 killer is alive?
Yes, they think he's alive. They think he's a suspect, and they think he's probably the Billy Brossman killer. And they think he's living comfortably in the Midwest.
And I know that the book mentions some DNA advancements potentially being able to help out, and we talked a little bit about this. Where
sure.
do we stand with that?
Well, in the 1990s, when the killings took place, DNA technology was only semen and saliva. And obviously, he's in and out in seconds, so there was none of that. But now DNA technology has evolved to what's called touch or handler DNA. For example, don't forget, in Terre Haute, Mick McCown's wallet is missing. Did he take it? Well, how would we even trace that? So about a couple months ago, I'm on a golf course with Detective Pat Rumsey of the Terre Haute Police Department. And I say, Pat, I said, even with the touch handler DNA, if he took it, how would we ever trace that? And Brad says to me, I'll tell you how we trace it, Bob, because deep down in my basement at work, there's a box that's got the name Mick McCown on it. And in that box from 30 years ago, I kept Mick McCown's pants. There you go. Again, detective work. And talking about giving up on a case, Brad Rumsey is still working on a case from 1967 in Terre Haute where a woman named Joanne Fox was murdered. He's got a possible DNA match 60 years later from a man in Florida who's now 80, who was 20 at that time. Brad Rumsey's on an airplane to Florida. These police department people, man, I just think it's incredible that the public knows. You think a case is forgotten, the homicide's not being solved. What are you doing on the killing of somebody in my family? They are working on it. It haunts them.
And one of the things that Abby and I talked about sort of recently, I think on one of our episodes, is how cool it is that even, you know, in the 90s or like you said, in the 60s, these cases, the detectives and the investigators were smart enough to know to save and preserve DNA because they were like, it could be tested in the future.
Yeah. The wedding veil in Wichita. So I go out to Wichita and I see Tim Ralph, who solved the BTK killer, who now has this one. And I say, you know, DNA's evolved to this thing called touch handler DNA. And I'm starting to talk and Tim says, I got the veil.
Yep. Good.
Had no reason to think he needed to save it 30 years ago, but did.
That's good. That's so amazing. Well, Bob, thank you so much. Something I kind of want to ask you just as we start to wrap up here, just maybe some of your general opinions and something you would want to leave our listeners with when thinking about the case, maybe any physical descriptions that we haven't hit on or general characteristics, what the killer may or may not be doing, where they may or may not be living in your opinion or the FBI profiler opinion.
I think they think the killer was a contractor who traveled the country and worked on odd jobs for big stores, you know, a Best Buy, a Big Lots, a Sears, a Kmart back then, whatever, Walmart, you know, doing repairs, traveling around the country, doing odd jobs. I think he lives in the Midwest near very, very, very near one of the murder scenes. They do have his DNA. They went after him for DNA, and he didn't want to give it. Well, they got a court warrant then to say, give the DNA, and now they have the DNA. So whether there's a match there, we don't know. So far, they've struck out on matches. The wedding veil did not match. Mick McCown's pants did not match. Now the DNA best hope is in shell casings for matches. Again, it evolves. DNA has also evolved now to genealogical DNA, where they test family members. This is what's happened right now in the Idaho College killings, where they're testing family members of that suspect. So DNA is evolving. But police, as much as the science has evolved, I'm telling you, police still think the best bet is a phone call. And the best bet might come out of this book. If we could have 100 million people read the book, somebody's going to see something and make that phone call. The police know it. You know, at my age, for everything I've done in my career, and I've covered a lot of big stories, just the fact that I could possibly in some small way help them or your podcast could help them. I mean, if they ever arrest that guy and it's because somebody from your podcast picked up the phone and called, we're all flying into the news conference together and they're going to thank us on the stage. I mean, how cool would that be? I'm just, my fingers
I think it would just be amazing. Yeah, I just think it would be amazing to have some answers for family members and friends and, you know, survivors of, you know, the I-70 killer, right? It would be fantastic if somebody picked up the phone and called, especially like we previously mentioned, we are an Indiana-based podcast, and we do have quite a few Indiana listeners.
If we can just get people to Google Billy Brossman and go watch that video, if we can get people to Google Irma Werke Gunn and take a look at those pictures and see if they've ever seen somebody who's seen that gun before, I mean, just right there alone would be the two things that would really help the police the most, I think, right now, if I could put my finger on any button.
Sure. And for our listeners, too, we'll post links and photos on our in our show notes and on our social media as well.
That's great.
Yes. And if anybody knows anything, who can they contact?
Well, they can contact the task force hotline, the number's in the book. They can contact any of the police departments of these cities that are involved, Indy, Terre Haute, St. Charles, Raytown, Wichita. They can call their local police department in the town they live in and say, I've got this. Can you put me in touch with? I mean, it's about as easy as you can get.
Amazing. Thank you again, Bob. We really appreciate it. And you know, just one more plug for the book. It's called Dead End, Inside the Hunt for the Interstate 70 Serial Killer. You can get it in a lot of places. I ordered it on Amazon, but definitely recommend it. As Bob said, we're trying to get the word out. A lot of people are trying to renew information in this case and just spread the word. Let people know what's going on. We really think a phone call is going to do it, and it's so important to so many people who have been involved with this case for a long time and people just getting involved like Erica and I.
Yeah.
And
well,
don't be afraid to pick up the phone, because that is like we've mentioned and like Bob said a bunch in this episode, is that's going to be what it is. So don't be afraid. I'm sure you can do anonymous tips as well if you contact the police departments. So.
Thank you both very much. I am incredibly grateful, and I can tell you I speak on behalf of all these police detectives who have given their life for this and how grateful they are. And everybody now is joined on the team. You guys are part of the team. Your listeners are part of the team, and that's how this is going to get solved. Somebody on one of these teams is going to make that call. I know they are.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Bob. It has been wonderful talking with you. And I'm sure our listeners enjoyed every part of this episode. You gave so much information and you did a great job telling all of the stories. You can tell that you've truly dedicated your life to bringing justice to these families.
Thank you both very much. I am forever indebted.
Thanks to listening to this week's episode of Crime Over Coffee. You can find us on Instagram at Crime Over Coffee or on Facebook at Crime Over Coffee Podcast, where all of our photo and video content for each episode can be found. You can also email us your thoughts and case suggestions at crimeovercoffeepod@outlook.com. All of our sources can be found in the show notes for each episode. If you would like, you can support us by going to anchor.fm/crimeovercoffee. You can also support us by recommending us to friends and family, giving us a good review on Apple Podcasts, or subscribing to us on your favorite podcast listening platform. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.